ladies and gentlemen. Now, John, I believe right of reply is yours. Joe was saying that absolutely all of the history being put across by Martin Dutre and others around the country is based on racism and absolutely nothing more. Care to respond to that?
Yeah. Yeah, bureaucrats tend to do that, and societies tend to do that sort of thing. Do you accept Michael's view on the massacre of the Moriori in the Chatham Islands? Because he's wrote a book about that as well. I'd like to put up this slide here, which talks about the real Waitangi we should be thinking about, the one in the Chatham Islands where women were staked to the beach and then slaughtered and eaten and so on. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that, unfortunately, you have to accept Michael King also talked about. But he, you know, you're saying that because Michael King wrote the definitive history of New Zealand as perceived by the establishment, that we must believe him and him only. And Paul Moon, when it suits you, you believe Paul Moon. You don't believe him when he writes this horrid practice about the cannibalism, but you believe him when he says things that you do agree to. I'm saying that all history is contestable. None of us were there. We don't know what really happened. That's the nature of history. We can only accept the assumptions of people who've studied, and Martin has studied it, as well as Michael King. You know, he's just as intelligent as Michael King and those other guys, and he deserves to put his evidence and be allowed to have his evidence considered. Michael King may never have seen it. He certainly took a lot of trouble to go over to the Chatham Islands and see the evidence there, and he wrote about that. You know, I'm just saying, give a guy a fair go. Don't demonise him because you don't agree with his agenda or his findings. Give the guy a go. Put him on this program, Vinny, up against Joe, or if there's a better person than Joe that can argue the toss about archaeology, give him his go. I reckon he'd lap it up. Then we'd see what we make of Martin Dutre, you know, in a fair debate.
Now, on top of this, there's the other element here is, in my opinion, the establishment in anything tends to be wrong most of the times about things, but you only find out that they're wrong in the fullness of time. For example, do you believe that JFK was the result of a conspiracy or a lone gunman?
I think he was the result of a sexual act between his parents, but that's just my view.
But in the fullness of time, so much things have come out, like the Zapruder film, etc., that have disproven and shown that every element of the official story has been debunked and is simply not true. However, what is the truth doesn't get accepted and brought into the mainstream consciousness, even though approximately 90% of Americans don't believe the establishment official account.
It's certainly true that we enjoy these things. You know, we kind of want to believe that it was a CIA plot or there was another gunman. And we kind of enjoy the idea that the American government might have brought down the World Trade Center. It's attractive, you know.
I don't know about you, but the thought that that there's a criminal, I'm not sure, John. I think that the fact that there might be a criminal element in charge of the United States that would kill its own president, much less 3,000 of its own citizens, is not a comforting thought to me, nor anybody who truly studies it.
Choice of word, attractive. It's not. It's attractive from the...
Intriguing, I think, is the word.
From this, yeah, from the sort of water cooler discussion point of view, we all like to have views on stuff, and we all like to, you know, believe that far-fetched things are going on. And we've got to discount all that. You know, I used to believe in, you know, at school, I read the books of Bruce Cathy about the, you know, Harmonic 695, Harmonic 30, all very, very attractive, you know, evidence for UFOs and so on. I'm still not saying it's wrong. I don't know. But it was kind of it was fun to want to believe it anyway. But you've got to discount all that if you're honest, and you've got to give both sides a fair go, and you've got to behave as though you're some sort of jury in a court of law. And I find that increasingly, or maybe it's just that I'm getting more interested, but I see things like the climate debate, and you see vested interests in both sides putting up very plausible cases. and God knows where the truth is. You just but it's the same with this, you know, this treaty debate. You know, we're both, I think, honestly trying to find the truth of these matters. I'm saying that Joe and Co. have a vested interest that I don't have. Do I really, you know, am I really trying to create a legacy for myself as a racist? Is that really where I get my jollies? I tell you, I'm not. I don't. Why would you? Maybe I'm just trying to speak up for people that aren't being heard, who just happen to be the majority, the hoodwinked majority. Maybe Joe and Co. are doing it for the money.
Mm. How do you respond to that? Oh, well, actually, before you do, I have another idea, because there are vested interests, and when in politics, who I vote for is either the person who gets most left out of the media or most demonised by the media. In New Zealand, that tends to be Hone Harawira and New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters. But anyway, Joe, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, John showed that little chart of his about the Chatham Islands and Moriori, I actually do accept the history of Michael King, because he's a professional historian. I've got no other reason to.
So is James Cameron.
But where it comes unstuck for you, John, and also Martin Dutre, is yous are talking about what the mainstream of New Zealand perceive as a conspiracy theory. But you also, on the other hand, yous are trying to convince the public of New Zealand that Alan Titford's innocent. Now, right. you either drop these conspiracy theories, or how are people supposed to believe yous that Alan Titford's been framed?
What do you want me to tell you? I mean, I provided evidence. I don't actually have it here, but I gave it to the girl from Māori TV, and she wouldn't put it on. An affidavit that a friend of Susan Titford's, Alan's sister-in-law, who didn't get on with Alan, said that she heard Sue say that her father confessed on his deathbed to burning down the house that she subsequently went and said that Alan burnt down. That's evidence. That's not proof, but that's evidence. That's as good evidence as there was in the whole of the rest of the trial, where basically her word was accepted for the things that Alan was supposed to have done, 39 things. He's been locked up for 24 years. No one believes that's fair. 24 years for crimes in which no one died. That is a state fit-up. At least the sentence is. Where else do you get a Minister of the Crown, John Carter, working with a wife in a property, in a marital separation case? Why would he do that, do you think? The rapes, I could go on. One of the rapes, she said, happened on or about the 7th of July 2009. She told the police that in her own diary. She didn't say that. She said, oh, Alan wanted sex. I said, no, he pushed me out of bed. Now, that's not very nice. It's the opposite of rape, however. So I'm putting up evidence, Joe, one after the other. I could go on, and you'll probably say that it doesn't account for anything. There's no reason why you could possibly find him innocent. I'm saying there's every reason why you could find him innocent. First of all, the state has a real reason to lock this bugger up, because he proved that the treaty claim on his farm that cost him his farm was a fraud. I can go into detail on that, and I've done it on my blog tonight in the complaint by Mike Baker to the Broadcasting Standards Authority, a whole list of questions that should be put to those people who were just blindly believed, like Paul Moon, like Alex Nathan, like who was the other one? I think Ranganui Walker. Just blindly believed. We're putting up evidence all the time. Martin Dutre does nothing but put up evidence. I put up evidence and you just laugh at it, you know. Well, I laugh at you for laughing at it, because you should be coming up with corresponding evidence. I'm saying a man was put away for 24 years for crimes he most likely didn't commit. There's certainly evidence he didn't commit the bigger ones. And you're just sort of laughing it off, I suppose.
So, well, hold on. Did he actually? What's the current penalty for murder in New Zealand? It's like life in prison, isn't it?
Look,
good behaviour, 25 years.
Murderers have got less than that. Graham Burton, one of the worst murderers, got 26 years. You know, Titford did nothing on that scale and got 24? Ask yourself. And they started, and the judge started his sentencing at 36. Can you believe? You know, William Bell got 33. It is just so obviously corruption on behalf of that judge and all the people surrounding the case, the police, people who bashed Titford up because he complained that the Maori were molesting him. That's why the father-in-law burnt the house down, incidentally, because he, it was the only way he could think of to get his daughter away from the threats and harassment and violence from Te Roro. That's why I wasn't going to, you know, apologise to them when Mihi Nairangi Forbes seemed to think that the highest priority was to apologise to Te Roro, not to Alan Titford. You know, it's just one of the policemen actually apologised, most heartfelt apology to Titford for the harassment that he delivered upon him and others. But Titford said, "Will you repeat it in public?" The guy said, "No, it'll affect my new career." So Titford said, "Well, I don't accept your apology then. Why should I?" But, you know, there's so much scandal going on in the last 20 or 30 years over him. His wife still believes that the research they did was accurate. So it doesn't affect the fact that he's been demonised, you know, like you guys try to demonise Martin Dutre and me. And, well, Titford was the arch enemy, so he was thoroughly demonised. But even if he did all those things as charged, as sentenced, doesn't alter a jot the work he did on the Te Roro claim and the fact that that was all shonky. There's no logic that connects the two. And his wife and he both agreed on that, which is remarkable considering she is out to get him in every other way. Mm. You know, she admits that the Maori shot the stock and did certain other things, but she claims, you know, when it suits her, that Alan burnt the house down, even though her father now did. But, you know, so that's something I want to get out, is that there's no connection between the two, but somehow the media have bought the idea that because he's this violent person in other parts of his life, that he must therefore be dishonest, which has nothing to do with violence, regarding the work, that the forensic work that he did on the claim. Hmm. It doesn't connect.
Can I get write a response on this, Vinny?
We're waiting. Go for your life, man.
Okay. Alan Titford is guilty as charged. Titford knew for 20 years that the people of Te Rāroa had not committed any crime. They hadn't burnt down his house, but he was silent. He didn't let anyone know. He didn't approach the police force. He just kept quiet about it. And what Alan Titford could you let me finish, John? Sure. What Alan Titford is a set of coincidences. First off, his boat mysteriously sinks. He gets insurance money for that. And then he goes in from that insurance money and he buys a farm. And then what happens is his house mysteriously burns down and the Waitangi Tribunal end up giving him $3 million. Now, that's a set of three coincidences that I just don't really buy. And then, now that he's sitting in prison, he's blaming it all on a dead patsy and is passing the blame on to the father-in-law. What Alan Titford is guilty of is he made Māori and Te Rāroa look like this avaricious group who are just very greedy, when it wasn't the truth. He turned Northland into Mississippi burning. He created so much racial tension that Māori hated Pākehā and Pākehā hated Māori. And if John honestly believes that Alan's getting a fair deal, well, I can bring up some examples of some Māori activists. There's Benjamin Petty Nathan, who damaged the America's Cup, and he got 2 years imprisonment. Annette Sykes was actually his lawyer. And all he did was attack a bit of steel. Now, Titford's been out raping people, committed perjury, committed arson, and he gets 24 years. Of course he should get 24 years. Also, Mike Smith just went up to One Tree Hill and chopped down a tree. No one was hurt. They're just destroying sentimental things. And Mike Smith ended up getting 6 months periodic detention. So if John thinks that Alan's getting off lightly, well, what about activists who are Māori? They don't get off lightly.
I don't think you're listening to anything. I mean, getting off lightly? I think Alan's getting off lightly, you're saying? 24
no.
years? That's what you said just then. But look, where do I start? Sunk the boat. Well, the boat was made of steel. There was petrol tanks there. You can't take an axe to a steel boat, as Sue Titford maintains. You said that the Waitangi Tribunal gave him $3 million. When? He bought his farm for $600,000. When he was forced to sell it, he got $200,000. The Māori TV program, quite mischievously, if that's probably the least of it, said that he made five times as much as he paid for it. Well, first of all, there was quite a lot of inflation at that time between those two dates, but he had to pay back mortgages that he couldn't afford to pay because the tribe occupied the land. He couldn't develop his beachfront property. That was the whole reason why he bought the farm, so that he could make a profit developing the beachfront property and so he could pay his mortgage back. There were other costs as well. He had to that included his stock, $700,000. You know, just complete misinformation from start to finish, Joe. I don't know. Well, I just don't know. When I hear stuff like that, I just think that people are there is a lower threshold of honesty going on here. It seems to be endemic in Māoridom. Treachery seems to be tolerated from the days when Maui double-crossed his mother, and it's still going on. Treachery in battle and treachery in debate. You know, we've got to have some sort of basis of truth before we can have a meaningful debate, and you're not coming from truth. You're coming from propaganda and indoctrination. And once again, I'm putting up facts, and you're spouting stuff that you've heard somewhere from someone biased. But, you know, if you look at that case forensically, he proved that claim was wrong, and he has been vilified for it. And that is the most ghastly thing that has happened in New Zealand for some time, and you're excusing it. You're saying that he deserved 24 years. Even if he had done those three rapes and the arson, which you're very happy to accept that the father-in-law had done because it exonerates Te Roro. Alan quite logically suspected Te Roro, they were doing so many other things to him, but even he came to the conclusion later on that it probably wasn't them. He couldn't understand what was in it for them doing that, so he had expressed that. He was prepared to change his mind, and rightly so. The first he heard of his father-in-law burning down the house was about the same time I heard it, when the affidavit came in. It wasn't from, as Mihir Nairangi Forbes said, one of the Titford family. It was one of the Cochrane family. It was his in-laws who didn't get on with him. You know, so just complete misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Joe, do you have a response?
Well, I think the only person who we need to look at here for treachery is Alan Titford. He's very treacherous. One of the things that he made a vast mistake on was he knew that he would upset Te Rārua if he went and subdivided the land, because one of the things that he knew of about the land, it was an urupa or a cemetery. And what the local iwi were upset about is they just wanted to connect with their dead ancestors in this cemetery or urupa. So this would fly in the face of common sense when you know there's racial tension. Why would you go and subdivide land, upsetting the people even further?
Because to pay off a mortgage, is what he said.
Yeah, to pay the mortgage. Why would
you? If you bought some land, then subdivided it so you could pay off the mortgage so that you wouldn't have to keep working for the rest of your life until you were dead to pay it off, wouldn't you?
It's like Dover Samuels. I mean, he said, look, you know, the white man is an idiot. Once you put a cloak on him, he turns to jelly. He said, look, we can make a claim that there's bones of our ancestors. We're such a bloodthirsty lot. There's bones of our ancestors up and down every beach in New Zealand, so we can claim the lot. You know, just because you've got a few bones in there, you're supposed to have cared so deeply for their ancestors. Why do they slaughter them in such numbers and eat them, you know? But the point is, this is the 20th century then. He paid a fair price for his land. He's entitled to use his land. If there are some bones there, well, so what? Why does that give someone else the right to come into his land? You know, those guys were threatening to kill. I've got to be a bit careful about who I name, but I think that Harawira was there. I think Shane Jones might have been in there on that protest. you just don't do in a civilized society. You don't go and occupy someone else's land. You go through the legal channels to apply for it, but you don't go and occupy. You don't go sticking a bloody pole on someone else's land. You don't go shooting the stock. You seem to think, with your morals, that you can do that, and that's what disgusts so many New Zealanders, that Maori think they can walk onto someone else's land that's been paid for and do whatever they like and disrupt his living. Well, he is a very determined man, and he wasn't going to put up with that, and he's paid quite a high price.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that's true for a moment here, and then just ask, if the reverse happened today, if a bunch of Pākehā walked onto a marae that was recently built, for example, saying that there used to be some Pākehā cemetery that wasn't marked there or something like that, would they be able to come onto the land and confiscate it from Māori, occupy it, that kind of, no, there'd be huge uproar. But the reverse is not true. And I think the reason why there's like an 80% or whatever a support of John's kind of theories and findings and whatnot is because maybe there's a little bit of racism involved, perhaps. I know, John, we've spoken privately. You've told me that there's a lot of racists that support you and you don't support them and you don't like to read their emails and whatnot, and when they comment on your blog sites, you tell them to clean up their act.
So there's
one element there, but the other element is people who believe in things like law, private property rights.
You can't have it both ways. You can't sign a treaty that where you sign up to the laws of the British Empire, for better or worse, and then you just take them into your own hands. I mean, that's just corrupt. And, you know, you've got to go through the process. And when it suits Māori, they're very happy with British law. When it doesn't, they're not. In 1941, again, for the second time, I think the first time was 1896, the law found that there was no case to answer over that the claim that there were two reserves, or they should have been provided in the sale of that land in 1876, I think it was. There was a pro-Maori judge who was an underling of the ultimate judge who thought that there was, but the ultimate judge, the chief judge, said there wasn't, so it was game over. But, of course, that never stops radical Maori these days. They open it up because they know they can get away with it, because they know they've got a kangaroo court called the Waitangi Tribunal that was set up deliberately to find in their favour, and guess what? It did. Well, that doesn't impress fair-minded people.
May I ask John or Joe, if you know the statistics on it, how many times has the Waitangi Tribunal not ruled in favour of the Māori claimant?
I'm not aware of.
Has it ever happened? Once?
I haven't studied the Waitangi Tribunal. But what did happen with the Alan Titford case is a law got passed through that private land was not to be used for treaty settlements. And because Alan Titford had been getting around burning down his own home, New Zealand law was influenced. So this was the 80% getting it wrong.
That's because the various prime ministers had promised. David Longy saying so in so many words that there will not, you know how he used to talk, yes, there will not be one farmer losing his land to a treaty claim. And, of course, he either was lying or he certainly got it wrong, because the Titfords certainly did lose their land to a treaty claim. And there was much more corruption involved than I've probably got time to outline. But they doctored the sale agreement. You know, Titford was prepared in the end, after his parents were threatened by the state with by the rural bank with taking their own farm, because it was collateral over the farm, which Titford couldn't afford to pay for anymore because the Maoris had occupied the thing and made it unviable. Nobody wanted to buy his sections. He reluctantly agreed in the end to accept a lower sum, but he changed the agreement. He said, I'm signing this, this, and this, but I'm not signing this, this, and this. Now, that was his opinion, and that's what he signed. And the Crown Law Office, who are extremely culpable in this, people like Scary Mary Ann Thompson, who was subsequently found guilty of that immigration fraud, people like her, doctored that sale agreement to rub out Titford's amendments. Now, that is a very shonky piece of work, and that is what the state does not want to get out there, and that's why I'm putting it out there. Things like that. Facilitating Maori claims because it was worth votes, and frankly, because people were intimidated. Peter Tapsell said to Titford, look, it's not fair, but I can't control my people. They're violent. They're going to get you. You'd really better get off the land and go and live somewhere else, because it's not going to stop. And it's that intimidation that I'm sickened by when it comes to radical Maori, and that's why I'm standing up.
And also, incidentally, because of the intimidation of time slots, we're also going to have to take a break and stand up for that. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. And
well,
indeed, welcome
this
back,
happened
ladies
to you
and gentlemen.
Listener-supported broadcasting, so go to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
I was invited on to Te Marae by the Sunday News Reader, Sunday Star Times Reporter Simon Day. I was uncomfortable about doing our interview there.
The High Tea Cafe.
Well, but I followed it on.
Now, John, we were talking about intimidation by radical Māori.
Said, I've had enough of this after he'd heard me talking for a while, and he ushered us off. And I said to him as I left, I said, actually, I support you. I don't think I should have been there either. But the same guy, when Mike Butler and I were protesting across the road as John Key was coming out, we had our Treaty Gate sign up there, and the same guy, big, burly guy, thuggish sort of guy, tried to rip our banner down. And I said, look, you can't do it out here, mate. I was wrong to be in there. I've acknowledged that. But you're wrong to menace us out here. Mike had encountered too many Maori tenants behaving like that towards him as a landlord and was not keen to get into a dispute. I actually was, because I thought it was the only way we'd get on TV. But, yeah, that was minor thuggery. But, that wasn't... That wasn't pleasant, but at least I showed up, and I was the only one who did show up from the entire 80%, and Mike, and we had our say. But, once again, we expected violence, and we got a certain amount of it, not too much.
And you don't approve of violence, even if it's Māori against Pākehā, do you, Joe?
No, of course not. I think what's happened up there at Waitangi is they're trying to cut back on the radical activism, so I think they'd start with John.
How many other activists like John are up there doing that kind of thing?
Oh, they have a couple of protests up there, but as John was mentioning, that he claimed that Te Rārua are a violent group. Well, history's actually proven that they're not violent, that Alan Titford is a violent criminal that rapes people. And he also mentioned in a modern society that you just don't do that. Well, first off, in a modern society, you don't confiscate land. The land there was an urupa, and it was actually reserve, inalienable land. And what happened is the government sold it to the Titfords when it should never have been sold in the first place. It was a reserve that belonged to Te Rārua. So they've got a fair grievance there.
Now, you said that they were trying to shut down certain points of activism. In your opinion, what kinds of activism should be shut down?
Oh, radical activism like Treaty Gate. Oh, and that's just a nasty hate group, Treaty Gate. So it should absolutely be shut down.
Yeah, if it's non-violent, it can be shut down anyway. If it's not proposing terrorism or anything like that, it can be shut down anyway.
Well,
let's think about the offences. Because with me, the only kinds of activism that should be shut down are those that breach common law. That's damage to private property and damage to human life, whether that be killing or maiming. Those are the only types of activism that I believe should be shut down.
See, TreatyGate is me sitting in this chair with this computer. There's no group. There's just me and people who read what I write. You want to shut that down. You don't believe in free speech. You're scared of it. You're scared of free speech, but you'll condone your own. You don't mind if the whole state machinery of education is corrupted to present your biased view of history. That's okay. That shouldn't be shut down. Just this lone guy who says things which are inconveniently disruptive of your indoctrinated views, that should be shut down. And I suppose Martin should be shut down, and Ross Baker's One New Zealand Foundation should be shut down. All of your opponents should be shut down. Well, guess what that resembles, Joe? Another Joe in Russia. Shut down your opponents. I think we've got to the real agenda of the Mana Party now. You know, this is why Annette Sykes says that we should be having a process of decolonization. Well, that's very similar to the Cambodian, the Khmer people saying, you know, let's clear the fields. You know, that's very bloody sinister, Joe, to shut down your opponent. I say, give full voice to my opponents. Let them embarrass themselves or make sense or ridicule me or whatever. Maybe I win, maybe they win, but let's have the debate. It's right. It's fair. Both sides heard. But you don't want my side to be heard. Now, that's going to be very interesting when viewers see this.
I'm not saying that you shouldn't be heard. I'm just saying you should be classified as precisely as what your group is. It's a hate group. There's no two ways about it.
Yes, there are.
Well, there are two ways. Here's an example of how it is a hate group. You just want to get one law for all.
Yep.
One foundation, New Zealand TreatyGate. You just want to acquire absolutely nothing for poor Pākehā. In fact, the Mana Party has many policies that cater for poor Pākehā. They realise there's a housing crisis. They want to get housing for poor Pākehā. But all these hate groups, they are fighting for absolutely nothing for poor Pākehā. All they are is a tool for the 1% that control 50% of the economy to be used as a distraction.
I've got no views on, Algerians, people in Tuvalu. I haven't got views about abortion. That's not what TreatyGate is about. TreatyGate is about rectifying an injustice that has been perpetrated on the people of New Zealand by a fraction of 15% of New Zealand. Of course we don't have views about poor Pākehā. That's not the issue. We're not a political party. I'm just me. You know, all those groups, they've got to be in their bonnet about the lies being told by people like you who stand there and say something is just because you want it to be. It's just wishful thinking. We wheel up evidence and you say, that's not right. This is true. What you say is not true. And you don't require any evidence at all. Well, I think the viewers of this program will make up their own minds about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you talked about an injustice. What you're talking about is in this injustice is anything awarded to Māori as an assault on the civil rights of mainstream Pākehā. That's absurd. There's no injustice going on. All we're doing here is honouring our country's founding national document, the Treaty of Waitangi. Look, and that's what is the basis of this nation that makes it a great nation when we look after our Indigenous people.
Well, the ones who came from the other side of the Pacific. The
what does the word indigenous mean, Joe? Does it mean they migrated here from another land, as the Māori say that they did? Or does that mean they migrated here first before somebody else did?
I've heard the United Nations version of the indigenous people, and it includes Māori. Māori are indigenous. And also,
no, I mean,
Māori
the definition of the actual word.
It's not the actual definition. It's the United Nations socialist dictator gang definition. It's the poor brown people that were there when the evil white people came. That's what Joe's definition of indigenous is. It's nothing to do with the actual word. It's just a self-serving definition that happens to suit radical Māori. But
I'm sorry, we cut Joe off in the middle of his response. Please, Joe, continue.
Sorry. No. Allow John to continue. I'm not sure what the actual definition, but I do know that the United Nations believe that Maori are indigenous. They're probably because Governor General Jerry Mataparai opened the inauguration of the Indigenous Conference in New York just a few weeks ago. So,
Oh yes, and Annette Sykes was talking in the green room about the hotels in Waikiki that she's going off to stay in for a global Indigenous Peoples Conference. I mean, surely it should be in a grass hut, but no, we've got to have the flashiest hotel. But I don't know where we're getting with this, really, because you keep coming back to the treaty being the founding document. The founding document of New Zealand actually was the Royal Charter of November in 1840, which was the document by which New Zealand became a separate colony to New South Wales. But the treaty is always the thing that comes up. The treaty was a sort of permission slip by which the Maori gave sovereignty to the British in exchange for retaining their property rights, the stuff that they used, not every invention of the white man that they might take a shine to in 100 years' time, their property, their land, their stuff, the land that they were working with and living on, in exchange for equal membership of the British Empire and protection from the French and each other, which was the real fear. But we have this thing that the treaty is the founding document. It was certainly the first document that was signed after the arrival of Hobson. The document that erected New Zealand as a colony was the Royal Charter of, I think it was the 16th of November, which eventually made way for the status of colony to be created in May 1841, I think it was. That's your
gentlemen, family. We've already gone well over time.
Can I respond to that one quickly?
Would you like to take a break and then respond to it afterwards? And we can do another 10 to 20 minute wrap up or even a half hour. I mean, something tells me this debate would never end if you give it sufficient time. So I say let's give it a little bit more time. Would you be prepared to stay on for a little bit longer, Joe, John?
Yeah, by all means. Okay. I'm amazed by your energy. Mine's starting to flag a bit, but that's good.
Okay, this is why we take breaks.
Yep.
Because caffeine is necessary.
Okay.
We will be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after a wee caffeine break and a WikiLeak. Make sure you go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or subscribe to give a regular gift into the bank account or the PayPal there. Also check out our sponsors, the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn, the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga, almost say Gourmet Soup Kitchen there, which is how I introduced her on my radio show the first time when I interviewed her. Frick, that was embarrassing. You should go back and listen to that interview, ladies and gentlemen, with Angela Foreman. That's some funny stuff, man. Anyway, she makes ridiculously good soap. Like, whoa. Especially, and I want to make a recommendation here. If you're going to go to the Gourmet Soap Kitchen, you're going to buy yourself a bar of soap, get yourself the cinnamon and oat bar, bro. That stuff is invigorating. It's like heroin to your skin, but not quite as pleasurable. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this extended episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I just thought as I mentioned in the end of the first segment, if this debate was a coffee bean, it'd be a robusta. And quite frankly, sometimes you feel like you need more than one coffee in the morning in order to get you up, in order to get everything sussed out in your head. And I don't think this debate's quite over. And even if I gave you another 25 hours or something like that of straight radio, the debate still wouldn't be over. If anything, having, in my opinion, probably one of the first kind of open format, honest debates on the topic and being able to hear both sides equally without anybody shouting each other down. I apologize. I appear to be more on John's side of this debate tonight, Joe, no disrespect. But I think it's been good to hear both sides in their fullness, and maybe this will help to trigger even further debate and get the issues truly opened up and resolved once and for all. This is my hope. And gentlemen, thank you very much for participating. So who would like to go next? Have you been reviewing notes and stuff over the breaks? I've noticed both of you have. And I believe Joe has a right of response to what John and I were last talking about. So, Joe, if you please.
Yeah, so John was talking about the Queen's Royal Charter that was made on the 16th of November, 1840. So the Queen's Royal Charter is 9 months after the Treaty of Waitangi. And what it declares is the government of New South Wales has sovereignty over New Zealand. So it'll be a really good founding document if we were trying to prove we were Australians. Secondly, the Queen's Charter has never been to New Zealand, so you can hardly call a document the Queen's Royal Charter or founding document if it's never ever been to your country, because, you know, the Magna Carta's been to Great Britain, the Declaration of Independence has been to the United States. So, and one of the problems all of these hate groups have is one foundation and Treaty Gate. They all claim all the other founding national documents, but the original Māori Treaty of Waitangi. So they have the Littlewood paper. I don't call it a treaty. It's just a scrap piece of paper found in South Auckland. And they also have the Queen's Royal Charter. So there's a lot of inconsistencies here. And what they're doing is putting up all of these other founding national documents that they find in South Auckland, as opposed to the original Māori version of the Treaty of Waitangi. In fact, I find founding national documents all over here in South Auckland. I've got a copy here of the Magna Carta, and this is the original of the American Declaration of Independence on George Washington. So I just find them all lying around. There's a couple lying around here that they're just everywhere. But normally, what most New Zealanders do is they go with the original Māori version of the Treaty of Waitangi and accept that as their founding national document.
Mm. Do that, like 80%. Well, anyway, a wonderful speech, but you think that the Queen Victoria's Royal Charter isn't in New Zealand. Do you think that the National Archives is not part of New Zealand? Because that's where it is, mate. It's got a gold seal and everything. It looks very much like... It's not a scrappy document like either the Littlewood document or the Māori Treaty, which is a pretty scrappy document as well. It's a very ornate document with a big gold seal hanging off it. It couldn't be more ceremonial. It doesn't make a huge difference, I don't think. Some people on my side say it makes all the difference in the world. I don't know that it matters which was the founding document. The Waitangi document was certainly, the treaty was certainly the first document, and it was the document by which the chiefs ceded sovereignty in that very good deal where they became equal members of the British Empire. But it just wasn't the document that created New Zealand. It didn't create the colony of New Zealand. It's just an unarguable fact. The Royal Charter created the colony of New Zealand. It separated us from the existing colony of New South Wales. There's no argument about that. I don't even know what the big deal is, really. But that was the document that founded, and that is arguably the founding document that we should be celebrating, that created our colony. I don't know what the point is you're making. You want to celebrate the Waitangi Treaty because it suits you, because you can attract attention to it and you attribute to it all sorts of things that weren't actually there. I mean, the great con job was the fact that the treaty that we talk about today is not the Treaty of Waitangi, it's the Treaty of Wellington 1989 that Geoffrey Palmer made up out of thin air, you know, the so-called principles of the treaty. You know, British law does not provide for nebulous principles. It's what is written is what is in every other law, but oh no, not when it comes to the treaty. It's what was imagined is what is, you know, what was imagined to be in the minds of those chiefs. Well, I think what was in the minds of those chiefs was probably what came out of their mouths on the Treaty House lawn. You know, that was pretty clear that they knew they were giving up sovereignty. Anyway, I've diverted a wee bit, but the treaty I want to put into the public domain, the Treaty of Wellington 1989, the fictional principles of the treaty that created the so-called partnership. Yes, there probably was a partnership, but partnerships don't have to be equal. There's no way that Queen Victoria would have agreed to an equal partnership with, you know, 70,000, well, chiefs that couldn't organize themselves into a nation to start with. They were just a whole lot of disparate tribes at each other's throats. I mean, that wasn't the British Empire's way. I don't know if you've noticed. But it wasn't an equal partnership that you like to pretend it is. It was a perfectly legitimate arrangement between two quite different types of entity. One, the greatest empire on earth. The other, a bunch of tribes who were quite numerous in these islands. The colonial secretary, Lord Normanby, issued a 4,000-word document to Governor Hobson, Lieutenant Governor Hobson, saying, "Do not take these islands by force. If the tribes don't want, if the chiefs don't want the arrangement, just sail away. We're not in that game anymore. We're wet liberals now. And if they want it, then we'll do it. Otherwise, we're not really interested in another colony." Now, that's the fact of the matter, Joe. There's quite a few things I'd like to get out that I haven't said yet, but I'm not quite sure what is the appropriate time to do that.
I'd say proceed, unless Joe wants to respond.
Yeah, I'd like to respond. Yeah, it would be lovely to have the Queen's Royal Charter as our founding national document if we wanted to be Australians. But I'd actually prefer to be a New Zealander and have a document as our founding national document that has been signed by New Zealanders, people that were born here, as opposed to Australians. And I noticed John talked about the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi made by Geoffrey Palmer, the Prime Minister at the time. Well, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, what they did is they bridged the power held by government and local government and the Treaty of Waitangi. So what they did is they brought it to the fore. So what you had is, for the first time in 100 years, city councils had to actually go out and visit the local marae. They actually had to acknowledge that New Zealand wasn't just this place that didn't have any culture or didn't have any founding national document. You had city councillors and mayors that actually had to go out and meet people who were indigenous.
Yeah, bribe the tribe. Yeah. They have to bribe the tribe if they want to do anything. That's the problem. It's not the treaty settlements. They'll be over soon. They'll be $3 billion, as you say, over 20 years. It's not huge. What really rubs people up the wrong way is having to bribe the tribe every time you want to do something. The tribe says, "Oh, we've got a tanifa under here. You can't build the road unless you grease our palms, of course, and then we can make the tanifa go away." That's just corruption, and that's what really sticks in people's craw. It's the bribe the tribe mentality of having to pay off the iwi every time you want to do something. That is the real drain on this country that Maori.
John, hold on here. Do you have any actual examples, like dollar amounts or particular instances or case studies, where money has been given to tribes in order to go ahead with private projects?
Let me think about that. There's plenty of them. Do I have them at my disposal right now? How much did they pay the tanifa to go away? I'm not sure. It was certainly a large amount. There's another one up in Auckland. All the time they're having to, you know, it's koha, it's supposedly koha. It's not co-governance, it's koha governance. That's what's going on. With every development, you have to, I got a friend, you know, he wanted to build a state-of-the-art holiday home, a small holiday home, but it was done well with a proper sewage system. The sewage system happened to be too advanced for the council, but he had to get the permission of not only that council, but three separate iwi to make a house which was more robust than the council provided for in its regulations. But he had to go to three separate iwi for that. Why on earth would you have to do that in a fair country? Why would you have to go to a small group who make up a lot less than 15% of the population, especially if it's an iwi basis? Why would you need to do that? You know, where is the moral? Where is the moral justification for that? I want to win this from the moral high ground. I don't want to just say, "Well, take all Maori's privileges away." You know, they shouldn't be there in the first place, and it should be done from a point of view of what is right and what is wrong. It's not right to do that. We're grown ups now. We shouldn't be, you know, paying homage to a group that really has no great claim, or no greater claim than anybody else. Why don't we go to the Chinese? Why don't we go to the Pakehas? We don't. I don't want to live in a white country. I don't want to live in any particular coloured country. I want to live in a multicultural country. It's very vibrant. I don't want the Islam. I don't want the radical
Sharia law.
I don't want Sharia law, but that's the only objection I've really got to any culture. What is so wrong with that? What is so racist about that?
He does have a fair point, Joe.
Oh, once again, what he's doing is he's pretending that anything awarded to Māori is an attack on mainstream Pākehā rights. And it's the reverse racism argument again.
And we will be right back after this little break here, ladies and gentlemen. I apologise to just cut you off there, Joe, but we'll be right back and we'll pick up where we left off. And welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because the world's so full of chaos and madness. If you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Now, Joe, you were saying that John's basic argument is that all
there's nothing happening to you
is,
if the Crown
basically an attack
offers
on
you,
mainstream
offers
news
Māori
and
compensation for the Treaty of Waitangi.
And
what I'll do is I'll actually read out the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. And what they're actually designed to do is to bridge goodwill between the Crown and iwi. I'll read them out. The acquisition of sovereignty in exchange for the protection of rangatiratanga. The treaty established a partnership and impose on the partners the duty to act reasonably and in good faith. The freedom of the Crown to govern. The Crown's duty of active protection. The duty of the Crown to remedy past breaches. Māori to retain rangatiratanga over their resources and taonga and to have all the privileges of citizenship. And duly to consult. So these seem like very reasonable
they do, Joe, but
principles.
I've got a question. Why are the two Māori words in there, taonga and tenaranga tiratanga, when everything else is English?
Like, okay, well,
are there two separate versions, or is the English version got Māori words in it that aren't defined in it? How does it work? Is there a full English version with the actual translation of those words, tereranga, teretanga, and the Dictionary of Modern Māori? Okay.
Yeah. So so taonga is a simple word. It means treasure. Of course, John's got an alternate meaning for the word that
was the definition at the time. But have we rewritten the treaty since the original, as you say, Joe, founding document? Is it a new treaty now that's got completely different wording to the treaty that was signed at the time by the chiefs on the lawn?
No, what it does is it bridges the gap between our founding national document, the Treaty of Waitangi, and local and central government. So what it does is it gets them to work with a bit of goodwill to each other. So we stop having these misunderstandings. I mean, duly to consult. I mean, how's that racial privilege? And they're using words like remedy past breaches. This is not racial privilege. It's it's trying to fix a colonial history that's an unmitigated disaster.
So how long have these mitigating factors been going on for, and has the average Māori benefited, statistically speaking, from these redresses of grievances?
Well, from what I heard the Māori Party say on the minor debates is that the Māori economy is up to $42 billion, but I don't see that. I'm not aware of what it is. But if you were to take Ngāi Tahu, for instance, they've managed to take $100 million in treaty settlements, and they now turned it into $5 billion in profit. So
here's a question on that, Joe. How many members of the tribe of Ngāi Tahu are there, and how many is the $100 million divvied up to?
Well,
or the several billion now. How many of those members of the tribe all have a stake? Does every member of the tribe by blood get a dividend check every year, as is customary with shareholders of a company? How does it work?
I'm not aware of the amount of money that they give each shareholder in Ngāi Tahu, because I'm not a member of Ngāi Tahu. I'm not.
Is Ngāi Tahu a tribe or a company?
It's a iwi tribe, but it has a trust that all its members are a party to. But
how does one become a member?
Well, what you have to do is you have to prove your ancestry into that iwi. But
if somebody wants to become a part of this trust and get dividends every year, all they have to do is find some trace documents, like go to ancestry.com or some variant of that, and trace their lines back, and then they get sent a dividend check every year?
No, they have to register with the iwi after they've proved their ancestry.
Is registration free?
Yes, it is. I don't know in Ngāi Tahu. I can't speak for them. But
everybody who's actually got ties to Ngāi Tahu currently has a share and is registered in it. So therefore, they're not actually representing the entirety of their tribe, are they? They're only representing those few who have the mental faculty and the education to be able to search their lineage and then register with an official kind of organization like the Ngāi Tahu Trust.
Which
disadvantages and basically cleans out most of poor Māori. I mean, even me, I don't have the education level to do that kind of thing.
I don't know that there's any... is anyone complaining that they're not able to get into the tribe if they want to? I don't know. But what I'm arguing is that Ngāi Tahu, who were 2,000 strong in 1840... scattered around the South Island, and they've now got 5 billion. Well, they're doing very well. There's nothing stupid about Maori people. But they don't deserve it. They shouldn't have got, you know, 170 million for 2,000 people when they'd sold the whole island by then. But anyway, putting that behind us, that's neither here nor there. The Maori economy is, I thought it was 39 billion, it's 42 billion. And guess what? The bad stats are as bad as ever. You know, the crime, the rape, the suicides, all that. They're still as bad as ever, and they've been shoveled lots and lots of money. Obviously, it's not... Honi Harawira tried that on me. He said, oh, we need lots of money because, you know, we've still got the bad stats. Well, you know, logic says you've got lots of money. It's not working. It's because you guys are getting it all. Willie Jackson says, oh, he's not getting it. Well, he drives his kid to school in an SUV to King's College, lives in David Longy's old house. He's getting plenty.
An American SUV. He's got a Dodge, one of the brand new ones, like maybe a couple of years old.
Yeah, so is Tamahiri. I mean, no reason. That's fine. But, you know, organisations have leaders and they have to be paid. But, you know, it's fairly clear the money isn't trickling down to where it's supposed to be. It's none of our business anyway. It's been given to them. They can do what they like. But don't come back for more. Don't say... oh, you know, you want a Maori TV channel? Fine, fund it. You got 42 billion. Don't come to us. Don't come to the wider public for more money after all of this. Most of it ill-gotten in the first place for dubious reasons. But you've got it, so use it. And use it, you know, you've got people like old Bob Mahuta used to say, oh, the state's still got to pay the welfare, despite the fact that, you know, it was a large proportion of welfare was going to the Maori. But why shouldn't the 42 billion help to pay it, since Maori seem to be so fond of it? You know, that's the sort of stuff that sticks in the throat, really.
If there's 42 billion, Joe, let's say these trusts were a non-profit organisation, how much money would that make in terms of difference to local Māori people and perhaps rural areas who are now having a lot of roading funding taken off them and things of this nature under UN Agenda 21 protocols? Rural areas are getting washed out and the Māori out there are basically stranded in poverty. What are these large tribes and organizations doing to help them? And is the Crown, i.e. everybody, paying to compensate people who don't give that money back to their people? How is that working for everybody? How is that advancing Māori when the statistics are only getting worse, Joe?
Well, First off, what Māori are doing is that they're turning $1.2 billion worth of treaty settlement, so it's not a lot of money, and if you count all the amount of money that Māori have paid since 1840 in tax, it far exceeds that. Mm. So what they're doing is they're not being neoliberal, they're using it for long-term investment. Now, you can't get long-term investment if you're offering welfare to all of your board members. It's illogical economically. So what this argument, the entire basis of this argument is that Māori should not receive treaty settlements based on the fact that it will not filter down to all the members within the trust or within iwi. Well, that's none of the Crown's business. It is absolutely none of the Crown's business.
What if we cut out the middleman? What if it was to go directly to the Port of Māori to help them, like with a car or paid up rent for a year or something? I mean, but then again, that does have a very good point there, is because as John has said, and I totally agree, Māori business is booming and it's very good at what it does. And a measure in net worth of the Māori economy is not a measure of net profit. I mean, and let's think about, say, the measure of the percentage of the economy in the United States is now 60% financial derivatives and financial speculation. And that's built on nothing but sand. It's not a reflection of the quote-unquote real economy. How much of this is all leveraged? In whose name is it done? And who benefits in the meantime from these long-term investments?
If they measure the Maori economy, if it's 40 billion, I think that's roughly 20% of the whole economy. In other words, they've caught up financially and doing well. It is none of our business what tribes do. It's just I feel sorry for the individual members of those tribes who are being shafted once again, as they used to be when they were slaves and so on. They're not getting it. I had a discussion with Mike Moore about this. He was very proud of having introduced the iwi model for compensation. I thought it was a disaster. I thought the money should have gone to the individuals to, you know, let them invest as they wish. But we have the iwi model, and suddenly everybody belongs to an iwi. They didn't before. Suddenly everyone thinks, right, people follow incentives. The incentive was get with the program, get with the iwi, become a member of an iwi. You didn't even know what it was before, but now you found out that if you sign up with Ngāpuhi or someone, you can get money. So they did. It's created all these neo-Māori, neo-tribes, neo-corporations. It's not real. But nonetheless, it exists. I'm just saying, having gone this far, no more. Rule off. That's it.
I'd like to respond to that. That this is the same as me saying that Irish people, Scottish, and English are all just British. There's no difference at all between any of those different groups. Iwi are an important part of Māori culture. That's how we identify with what part of Māoridom we are. If we just can't just lump all Māoris into this Māori basket and they're all the same and just get one payment and that's for all of them. And a lot of iwi haven't been paid out. Ngāpuhi are still to be paid out. You know, some of the most impoverished New Zealanders live in Kaikoi and they haven't had a treaty settlement yet.
What were the grievances? What were the grievances that they're claiming for? I wasn't aware of any wars up in Ngāpuhi there's a lot of intertribal wars, but I'm not even sure what they're supposed to be getting their loot for.
And also, Joe, might I ask as well, you're saying we can't lump all Māori into this thing because all Māori identify with the tribe. And in so doing, you're throwing all Māori in with that. I've known plenty of Māori, only a few that I know are actually really have any identification with their tribe whatsoever. Many of which have never been on a marae in their life.
Just to clarify, I wasn't meaning that you just give them to people, anyone who's Māori the same amount. Yeah. Do it by tribe, you know, identify the tribe, but don't give it to the tribe. Hmm. Give it to people in the tribe.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
You give it to the tribal leaders, you get what happens with all big corporations, the leaders, you know, like you look at the African dictatorships and so on. The leaders always take it for themselves.
Similar thing happened when the English compensated people in Canada for their tribes, and wealthy elements within them behave very corruptly and basically driving around in Hummers while the rest of their people are freezing and going hungry. And I believe a similar thing to a large extent is happening here. And is there a methodology of getting equity for Maori tribes members, whether or not they've proven their stuff or not? I mean, shouldn't that be something you can do in school easily? You know, this is like one of your first things you do when you're 10 years old or something like that. And in school, is that you have to trace your ancestry back to know which tribe you come from and get automatically signed up to your tribe's dividends, for example.
I was on Willie Jackson's show for 2 hours. It was rather similar to this. You know, Joe is sort of on his own here, and I was on my. But just like you're, I think, treating us both fairly, Willie treated me very fairly. He got stuck in, of course, but good credit to him. But where he was uncomfortable was when I mentioned that, you know, who do you speak for, Willie? How many people do you speak for? How many of your, you know, tribe or whatever actually agree with you or benefit? And that's where the leaders find it very difficult, because they know that it's not many. It's mainly them and their extended families and you know, the corporate people. It's the corporate people. But the ordinary Joe, no pun intended, is not really getting it, and should be. But it's none of our business. It's their business, you know.
So you agree with us, Joe, that the majority of Maori members of tribes should benefit from settlements and business interests and what have you, and they should be beneficiaries to the trust. And every trust has beneficiaries and trustees. I believe that people like John Tamahere and Willie Jackson have done not only very well for themselves, but also for their tribes in their dutiful running of their daily business and whatnot. Don't you think that's fair?
No, I agree with John on the point that it's none of our business. This is how trusts run. It's up to the trust how they run. And this is being used as a twisted argument to deny iwi treaty settlements. And
but you're not
John
actually
mentioned
denying
earlier.
Iwi. You're denying a certain group of people who've managed to prove that they're iwi and leaving the rest out of the equation entirely.
Are you sure? Well, I don't know that there are. I don't know that there is evidence of that. Is there any, really?
I'm not sure. I'm asking.
I agree that Joe agrees with me. It is none of our business, and it's not part of my argument anyway as to the fairness of the.
I'm not saying what they should do. I'm just, you know, throwing out balls of fire. Like, this was what I would do if it was mine to give. This would how I'd be equitable to my people and whatnot.
The group that's not being heard is the good, fair-minded Maori who are getting on with their lives. Are intimidated by the leaders. A lot of them write to me, and a lot of them from Australia. They're intimidated. They're too scared. The whites are too scared as well. But the Maori who agree with the likes of me are too scared to stand up on the marae. I don't blame them, and say, you guys don't speak for us. They're very frustrated with them, but they just, you know, they're not quite in a position to stake everything and put up with the odium and God knows what else would come down on them. So, you know, I think it's fair. When I make my statements, I'm talking to those Maori people, the ones that I know, who aren't getting heard. And the radicals are in control. They're only a small group. A lot of Maori don't like to be patronised like this.
And if they're representing an organisation and it's this operates in many ways the same ways as a company, companies are entitled to privacy and secrecy and all of those kind of things, so long as they're not breaking the law and getting investigated, right?
Yeah, these are just political groups, and it's the same in our, you know, in our parliament. We entrust our politicians, for better or worse, with doing the work so that we don't have to, and I suppose tribes are no different, and the people, the ordinary people in the tribe, have to put up with the decisions made by the leaders. But it's just a shame if that money is not getting down to where it would be sorely appreciated, I suppose. But as I say, Joe, none of my business.
So, Joe, do you agree that most of the money should go to the administrators of the trust and the rest of the tribe? If they don't prove their lineage, they don't deserve any?
No, they everyone who's a member of the iwi should be entitled to part of the treaty settlement, and however they divvy that out. But I'm not aware of the internal functions of how those trusts work. I don't really get involved in that side.
But if you're advocating for treaty settlements and using the growth in the Māori economy to make your points, wouldn't it be prudent to know precisely how those things actually work to be sure that it's not all smoke and mirrors, so a couple of people can suck up all the wealth for themselves?
No, I don't see if it's any of my business.
It's not any of our business, and it's not any of your business.
Well, all I want to do is I want to see this country get right, and I want to see the treaty settlement process to be fair and to be full. However, yeah, that's divided once it's with the trust, that's none of my business. That's how the iwi need to decide on that.
So if it needs to be fair and it needs to be full, but the iwi by themselves decide on it and they decide to keep it for themselves, is that fair? Is that full?
Well, what you're getting at is that the Crown shouldn't be giving out treaty settlements.
No, Joe, that's the direct opposite. I think that compensations should be made, and I believe that a framework has already been laid out to give a certain amount of money. What I'm wondering is, how exactly are these iwi planning to do with it, and are they going to be transparent about it so that they can be held accountable just as the Crown should be held accountable?
Well, I've seen
their people, aren't they? Their people, not to us. They're accountable to their people. That's what Joe would probably say, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I agree with John, yeah.
So who of your people is trying to hold the iwi to account for financial management and what have you?
I believe it's the Māori Land Courts.
So they have a regulatory authority over the governance of the trust. They can look into them, investigate them. There's no secrecy from them, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't think so. The Serious Fraud Office gets involved. I think it's the Māori Land Court that governs there. And if you have an issue with your iwi or the trust within the iwi, you can approach the Māori Land Court.
Well, that sounds very similar to the way the Police Complaints Authority works. It's all staffed by police, and many of the complaints don't get held up.
Vinny, may I...
But that's pure speculation on my part. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
I think it is speculation. I've got a slide to bring up here. Full and fair, but also final. Now, I've got a slide here, if you can see it. Tell me if you can.
Pull it back.
I think you'll find...
Basically, just hold it in front of your face, mate. Oh, wait, here we are. A little bit up further. What does it say? Final settlement of the Ngāi Tahu title.
Yeah, 1944, I think it says. Now, this is the sort of thing that I object to, this re-litigation all the time. Ngāi Tahu have had five full and final settlements. Tainui have had four. You know, I fronted Chris Finlayson at Orewa, of all places, because of the significance of Orewa. I thought I'd go along to a meeting he was having of the National Party. And he said, it won't be final, though, will it, Chris? They'll be coming back for more. It's all the Māori people say that. You can't bind one generation. You can only bind one generation. So they'll be back for more. And he said, no, if these aren't final, I'm Rumpelstiltskin. Well, I think he is. What people want to know is that this, you know, $2 or $3 billion, whatever it is, for whatever reason, that is a fact. And when Naipuia paid off and a few others, that'll be that. That it is that. That they're not going to be coming back and saying, ah, we were just kidding. It wasn't really full and fine. We've now got a whole lot of other reasons why we need more hundreds of millions of dollars. That's what people want to know, and that should be put in stone somehow or other. Mm. Except it didn't work in this case, because there's an act of parliament, you know, for the full and final settlement of Ngāi Tahu in 1944. It's an ongoing thing. It's a scam as far as I'm concerned, and people need to see the end of it. They'll say, right, our consciences are now clear. I mean, I haven't got anything on mine, but a lot of people seem to think that the compensation was richly deserved, but there's got to be an end, and that's what needs to go through Parliament or something, or they need to take away the Māori seats or the means to extort more, because it is extortion, and you know, we now should go forward as a racially neutral country where race doesn't enter into it. It's all about the human race, and all of that past grievance can be set aside, and we all go together. I feel for the patronised Māori, really, and I'm actually hoping that as a result of my efforts, those people might feel more like equal New Zealanders than they do now, where they feel like patronised New Zealanders, and the only way they can become equal people is to go to Australia. And that's pretty wrong.
Yeah. Well, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with John Ansell and Joe Trinder. Now, Joe, I believe you wanted to respond to John's talk about the treaty settlement, the 1944 one.
That treaty settlement that that John's shown there, 1944, I think it was in the order of approximately £50,000 or £25,000. That document that John's just shown was in 1944, and I believe it was in the order of approximately £25,000 to £50,000. So this was to Ngāi Tahu. What this treaty settlement was, full and final, was for the entire South Island. Now, this is a landmass that is the size of England and Wales combined. And at the time in 1944, Māori were second-class citizens. So what this is it's the bare minimum amount of treaty settlement. And in 1944, for that amount of money, you could buy one Lancaster bomber. So to get the amount for one Lancaster bomber for a huge landmass is unrealistic. And so with treaty settlements, they need to be fair and full, not as quick and final as Auntie Helen would prefer, but they have to be fair and full so we can put this issue to bed for the remainder of this nation's history. So currently, treaty settlements are only 2% value of the original land, of the original estates that were promised in the Treaty of Waitangi would be undisturbed. So if we manage to get this right and we give a fair and a full treaty settlement, then we'll be able to put this to bed.
But the statistics of Māori will continue as usual, because it doesn't matter how much compensation has been given out so far. It doesn't make the statistics any better. To me, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't give them the money. It means that there should be some kind of accountability for where the money goes and who in the tribe it benefits, perhaps. I don't know, but it's their business to sort out, as was stated.
Can I possibly shed some light on these numbers? Because I'm reading the document here. Joe is six... 100 to 1200% out by my dodgy maths. It says here, payment of £300,000 in settlement of Ngāi Tahu claim, whereas the persons now interested in the claims have agreed to accept the payment of the sum of £300,000. Now, that was an absolute fortune in 1944, considering there were only 2,000 Ngāi Tahu in the South Island in 1940. That's not a bad return. You know, 300,000, which must be many millions today. I'm not sure what factor you inflate that by. The point was they agreed. And when they agree, they're not entitled to come back, are they? And they came back, I think, in 1969 and got some more, and then, of course, later on in the 90s. So that's why I say, when will it end? I'm not so concerned with who gets it in the tribe. That's between their leaders and them. And they're entitled to militate if they want to, as in all parties and organisations. But the issue is, how many more times can they come back for more money? Because it's become an issue of money over mana, and there's no mana in taking other people's money. Mm. Even the $5 billion, you can't say that the $5 billion was gained by their own efforts. This is the thing, you know. A lot of Maori seem to believe that sitting around living on rents on inherited land is the only way to make a living. And if they haven't got land, they can't make a living. And they must find ways to get more and more of the terrible white man's money. And they've got to drop that idea. A lot of Maori are much better than that, and they're living very good lives and running successful businesses. The biggest business in the town that I'm sitting in at the moment, where I live, is owned by a Maori. It's a trucking company. He's doing very well. It's bad for people to think that the only way they can get money is to extort it from others. Mm. Rightly or wrongly, it's got to stop.
Joe, do you believe that the trust should be able to litigate infinitely against the Crown forever and get compensation every single time?
Well, I honestly believe that we have to get it right the first time and stop giving out piddly little amounts of money, like $300,000 for piece of... If you let me speak, well, 300,000 pounds for a landmass the size of England and Wales. If I was to go and take 300,000 pounds over to the UK and say, oh, could I please have England and Wales, they'd laugh at me. And that's ridiculous. You can't buy a big landmass the size of the South Island for that ridiculous amount of money. And if you do feel uncomfortable with giving iwi money, then just return the land. That's perfectly fine. Iwi will be very comfortable with that. It said in the Treaty of Waitangi that it would be undisturbed estates. This is the key word here, undisturbed estates, not confiscated. It's undisturbed.
But you're not suggesting that the entire... But you're not suggesting the entirety of the South Island and everybody's current property on it should be given back to the ownership of Ngāi Tahu.
Well, hold on. The statistics that John has got of Māori only being 2,000 people of vast inaccuracies. Hobson described that when he first came to New Zealand, there wasn't a part of it that was not inhabited by Māori, and Ngāi Tahu had managed to populate, even in Cook's travels, they had all of Banks Peninsula, there were parsites up there. Even when HMS Resolution was in Fiordland, there was Māori living in Fiordland National Park. Well, no one lives there now, but every single part of the South Island had been colonised by Māori. Now, if the Māori population in the South Island was decimated because of European disease being introduced, and also from Māori being excluded from the public health system. Well, how's that the fault of Ngāi Tahu?
You've got to state facts, though, Joe. You see, even Steve O'Regan, so-called Tipperary for certain circumstances, when you argue with him about the 2,000, he says, no, that's outrageous. There were 7,000. Okay, 7,000 then. That's not many, is it, for the whole South Island? They weren't using most of it. They were in little family groups. Yes, there were some in Banks Peninsula. There were some on Fovo Strait there. They were in little family groups dotted about the place. They didn't use the middle of the island. They didn't go there. They weren't entitled to it. You know, they weren't using it. It's, we've got to talk, you know, we're just coming from different moral bases here. And if we're not coming from truth, it's a bit pointless having a discussion. If Steve O'Regan says there were 7,000, I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt, even though I've also seen that there were 2,000. But it's not many, and it's not worth paying somebody for the entire island. Billy Jackson would have you believe that they should be, you know, the real figure should be sort of 70 billion or 30 billion, I think. Today's value. What a bloody cheek. Today's value improved by the Pākehā, the evil colonists, largely by the efforts of the people who were not Maori. That's why it's worth 30 billion today. You know, you talk about Auckland. Well, Auckland, of course, is worth a fortune today. But when it was, when Hobson first went there, it was just a bunch of volcanic cones, largely empty because of Maori raids of one sort or another. The South Island was largely empty because of Te Rapraha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know.
Well, there seems, it seems, just come from one side. Can I just see, I seem to think of a parallel here. I don't know if you've seen the film The Social Network about the founder of Facebook, and it wasn't entirely Mark Zuckerberg's own idea. He developed it, he worked it, and he made it happen, and he came up with all the programming and everything, but he didn't come up with the idea. And so they paid handsomely the two twin rowers for coming up with the idea, but it wasn't anywhere near what Facebook at the time was worth. Now, if you're just sitting there, and you happen to be there, let's talk about compensation. Somebody's been wronged, they need to be compensated. I was wronged once when I was in Dunedin. I had $5,000 worth of equipment and change and stuff stolen from me by a flatmate who skipped out and crossed his name out on the lease. Okay, the police caught him and they awarded me compensation of $75. I didn't think that was fair, but I can't go and infinitely prosecute him for doing that to me until I get the full amount back. It's not going to happen. I had to let it go and make what I could from what I had, and I haven't done too bad a job at it. Could that be done?
Well, first off, Eddie, am I able to address
Oh, sure.
John's assessment on the population of Māori in the South Island?
Steve O'Regan's assessment, yeah.
Well, first off, Te Rapraha is probably one of the greatest New Zealanders that has contributed to our national heritage than any other New Zealander, because he invented the All Black haka. And this is one of the proudest ceremonies that the New Zealand All Blacks do before they play any game. And I would say that's one of the reasons why they win a lot of their rugby games, or the majority of them. They're the most, they've won more games than any other professional rugby team. But what John likes to portray Te Rapraha as is some vicious savage that that went on an ethnic cleansing trip around the South Island, when I've actually read about Te Rapraha, and it's not true at all. He was actually very he was actually very forgiving to his enemies, and when he attacked Parsites down in Canterbury, he would actually get the lieutenants of the defeated iwi, and he would make them his own lieutenants. And Te Rapraha was Māoridom's greatest empire builder. He ruled an area from Christchurch all the way up to Whanganui, with an H, John. That's with an H, yeah.
Yeah, pronounced Whanganui, yeah. But what's that got to do with what we were talking about? He still ethnically cleansed the South Island, didn't he? I mean, he still, and he still, ripped open a pregnant woman and roasted a fetus on a stick. I mean, that's the sort of stuff he was up to. What did he do about the people he captured and took back to Kapiti Island? I think he tortured them by a red-hot poker. Look, it's not as though my culture is lily white in that area. You know, the hanging, drawing, and quartering of prisoners and burning of witches. But nonetheless, and his son, who was a fine man, apparently, Tamihana, was it? I can't remember. Tamihana Te Rapaha, I think, went on a tour around the South Island also, apologising for the sins of his father. So that gives you an idea of what he was up to, what Te Rapaha was up to. But we were talking about the population of the South Island, and, it wasn't many, was it? At £300,000 was $600,000 multiplied by whatever the inflation was between 1944 and now was quite a lot of money. And the point is, really, that they accepted it. But being basically dishonest, they came back for more years later because they could get it. I'm not saying that they – well, good luck to them. You know, they were given it. Hmm. They were given $170 million, which is now $5
billion. You saying that everybody in the tribe is corrupt and dishonest or just the ones who got the money and did all the litigation?
I probably went too far. I see a lot of dishonesty among the Maori leaders, so I'm not actually saying that they were just opportunists. They saw an opportunity and they went for it. They misrepresented the history, the populations and all the rest of it. Maori aren't the only people that do that in court cases. My real beef is with the governments that gave it to them.
Gentlemen, if I may, I feel that there's a problem in this country and a problem around the entire world, and this problem is scumbaggery. And scumbaggery knows no borders, it knows no race, it knows no colour, it knows no creed. It knows only the desire for power and control.
Well, it's incentives. People respond to incentives, don't they?
Do you think, Joe, that there might be, I mean, are you even prepared to accept the possibility in that there might be some scumbaggery going on involved here in the treaty process and some people doing it for their own gain and not for the greater good of their people?
Yeah, I think what there is I think there's some scumbaggery going on in these alternate histories that John's talking about, and the fact that the diaries of Her Majesty's Bark Endeavour describe that Māori were living in every single part of the South Island. And so I've seen a couple of these radical books that say that the Ngāi Tahu people there's only about five of them living in the South Island. They're just inconsistent with the records of Her Majesty's Bark Endeavour that Captain Cook recorded. He recorded many Māori. They even attacked him in, near Nelson or Queen Charlotte Sound. So
did Captain Cook go inland the South Island and explore the whole place? Or I thought he was a sailor. He navigated around it.
Of course he didn't. No. And that was 1769. That was pre Te Rapaha.
So they couldn't have known if there were people living all over the South Island because they hadn't looked.
They were around the edges in little family groups, and that made a total of 7,000. There would have been a lot of different areas. It's well documented. I mean, even Steve O'Regan knows it.
Te Rapaha is actually a very great New Zealander, and he's got a stadium named after him.
I know, because of the sycophantic Porirua City Council. I think it's outrageous. But, that's what they did. Nobody complained except me, because they've got these sort of carvings outside with great erect phalluses on, which the kids have to go past on the way to their swimming lessons.
And let's not forget, Saddam Hussein also had a statue of himself.
Well, not in that condition, I don't think.
My point is, just because somebody's revered by some, it doesn't mean that they're a saint or completely without wrongdoing in any sense of the word.
Well, I'd like to go into that, if we're going to be talking about genocidal maniacs. I'd like to explain Oliver Cromwell, who was responsible for 618 deaths of pregnant babies and unborn babies and women, and he killed approximately 40% of the population of Ireland. And they've named a township after him in Otago called Cromwell. So I think, you know, what we should really be looking at is renaming Cromwell to that praha, because we don't want to endorse genocidal maniacs. We want to endorse people who contribute to our national culture. Like Te Rapaha, we've given the All Blacks the haka. Oh,
right. Well said. Yes, that man. I mean, I'm not sticking up for Cromwell. I'll take you at your word on that one. Mm. A lot of bad people have had things named after them and so on. Mm.
Other than that,
sure, inventing a cannibal dance actually qualifies you for greatness, but he certainly was a paramount chief in his day, and there's no denying that. Pongihika was another one. Massacred an awful lot of people, but he prevailed, and that's what it was all about. It was might is right, and they were right because they were mighty.
Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen. I think that that's all she wrote, more or less, for tonight. It's now time for the closing statements. Joe, would you like to go first?
Yeah. Well, I put it to you, Mr. Ansell, to get your people to confront their racism and to stop turning Māori against Pākehā and Pākehā against Māori. And this is one law for all, NZCPR, Treaty Gate, and all these different hate groups to stop this war on the people of New Zealand. And instead of singling them out as being privileged, and all we're doing here at Mana is just trying to fight for Indigenous rights, the same as what the United Nations are trying to fight for. And we've had to, as Māori people, we've had to fight for everything we've ever received from the state, from Māori television to treaty settlements to even our own language being legal in our own land. And please stop pretending anything awarded to Māori is an attack on mainstream Pākehā. Thank you, Mr. Ansell. I put it to you that.
Thank you, Joe.
All right, John, your final statements?
All right. There are cases of racism in this country. I'm appalled that as recently as the 1960s, there were people advertising for flats saying no dogs, no Maoris. This is inconceivable today. But we've grown up. We have come past that. The most despicable cases of racism by my people, my race, if you like, were those inflicted on the Chinese in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the vicious racism right up to the state level, poll taxes and so on. I contrast those two people. I married one of the Chinese people, so I have some knowledge of their attitude, the attitude difference between Maori and Chinese. The Chinese way of dealing with that appalling racism was to put their heads down and work hard, knowing they weren't going to get any money, and beat the white man at his own game, if you like. They may not have thought of it like that, but that's what they've done, and I think we all admire that. Maori are obsessed with looking backwards, looking for ways to make money, looking for ways to coin it at the expense of the evil coloniser who they show no gratitude to for whatsoever. That's what gets in my throat, really. No gratitude at all for the major enhancements that they've had. You know, it's about being fair. It's... there's nothing that I have ever said anywhere on the internet that is actually racist, because I'm not. There is a vast difference between criticism and racism. I ask you to think about that next time you want to label me. I am critical when I see unfairness from whichever place it comes, and I see unfairness in this area, and I'm going to talk about it. And I'm going to keep talking about it for as long as I can or as long as I'm asked. If I can be shown that the facts that I've found are not true, I'll be the first to say so. I've said so on one or two occasions. There is no plot. Treaty Gate is just me. That's all I speak for. If people want to agree with me, then, you know, I guess I speak for them too. But there's no compulsion. And these other groups, they're not making money out of it, as far as I know. I'm certainly not. And we're only doing it because we care about sticking up for our people too. By our people, I include my forebears and the rest of New Zealand who aren't really getting much of a hearing when the whole state seems to be siding with the whole sort of treaty process.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hope, Joe, that you can see where I'm coming from and realise, even though you don't agree with me, that I'm not a nasty person. My motives are pure by my own lights. And
you certainly haven't gained anything by it, bro.
I hope we can agree to disagree. Like Willie Jackson and I, we've got a photograph of arms around each other. I've put a caption to it which says racist in the middle, and it's pointing to both of us. We both think each other is a racist, and that's okay by me. You and I probably think each other is a racist, but hopefully we can celebrate each other's humanity.
Yeah, I think there's a good one. Oh, gentlemen, it's been a mission, you know, and I think this needed to happen so that even if the three of us maybe can't agree. I mean, in fact, come to think of it, in this last segment, I realized I had very different opinions to both of you. I think that this kind of really needed to happen. This discussion needed to be a little bit more open than it previously has been. And I think it is central to this so-called idea of democracy, which in the Latin means mob rule. I don't like that kind of thing. It's essential to the idea of fairness and transparency and freedom in and of itself, specifically to listen to the people you don't agree with, listen to the people you think are crazy, and consider what they're talking about without dismissing everything offhand, without looking into it in its entirety and making our mind up one way or the other without that investigation. And I think everybody who has listened to this can now say that you have now a large amount of facts and evidence displayed by both sides, and you will have to use your discernment and your ability to confirm facts and evidence for yourself in order to figure out who is telling the truth and how New Zealand can progress as a whole with one race, the human race, whether that be everybody has all their individual liberties, or whether that be we can tolerate the scumbaggery in this country, whether it be from our politicians, community leaders, or anything. I will not tolerate scumbaggery in my country, regardless of who benefits from said scumbaggery, even if it's me. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And also, be reminded, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so you can go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make a donation today, or set up a regular monthly gift amount going into the PayPal or the KiwiBank accounts there. And we have a number of Wii sponsors on the website as well, including a number of books, How to Raise Crowdfunding Capital by Kevin Lawton, and The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And you stay classy, San Diego.